Hello and welcome to another episode of Girls on Film, a podcast where ladies talk about movies. My name is Melissa Hansen, and today we have an interview with Neil Huff, who has a pivotal role in the Oscar-nominated and Independent Spirit Award-winning film, Spotlight. This is the true story of how the Boston Globe uncovered the massive scandal of child molestation and cover-up within the local Catholic archdiocese, shaking the entire Catholic Church to its core. You may be thinking the movie is a heavy drama, but writer-director Tom McCarthy and his co-writer Josh Singer managed to balance the emotions so that even though the subject is dark, you are left with hope. Neil and I talk about his role and the real person he portrays, Phil Saviano. Here's the full interview.
You've had a fantastic career and still going strong, definitely.
I don't know who's told you this, but
I've obviously been looking up all the different roles you've had, and you've just had great luck in getting some really pivotal parts, and obviously in Spotlight that's one that's been gotten the most recognition, it seems like, definitely this year.
Yeah, no doubt.
So how has that been sort of getting in the spotlight for this when, there's been so many other roles that you've been in?
Well, it's a good question, because I just, for some reason, in the kind of person, really, that, my looks change very, very easily. So with certain projects that I've done in the past, it takes a little bit of explaining to say that I was in them. I was in a film that I'm so tremendously proud of called Meek's Cutoff that came out in 2009 that Kelly Reichardt directed. It was a tremendous cast and just it was a great, great part. And but again, you'd really never know that it was me just because my look was so different. I was like 30 pounds lighter. I had this grizzled beard. And so for this year to be in something that people immediately know is me. I'm not even entirely sure why, because I guess that character just really looks like me, and also the nature of the scene, the physics of that scene, I'm talking four pages of this, amazing film. So just that, I think plays into what's going on in terms of the really lovely recognition I've been getting for the thing. And also just that it's such a pivotal scene, it's a moment in the film where I think it takes the investigation to a much more, you see a personal stake in the investigation that you haven't otherwise seen up to that point in the film.
Well, and what's interesting is, I was reading about Phil Saviano. And there was an interview that he did, I think, with the Daily Mail of Boston, and mm-hmm. he said, I think Neil Huff comes across as more angry than I am. And I thought that was interesting because I think you had to be. I guess I was wondering what conversations maybe you had with Tom or, how that came across, because I think the intensity was very important for that scene.
Well, Tom was very, very clear that he wanted the scene to be not a typical, tearjerker kind of scene. He really made it clear to me on set that he wanted it to feel like this man had been doing this for years. Not that he was coming in and sharing something that he'd never spoken about for the first time. He wanted to feel that this man had this box, was going to people, as indeed Phil was. He went to two different journalists at the Globe, no one on Spotlight, years prior with all of this information that he had. And this is years after he had already been reported out, by the Globe as a survivor of abuse. And then he came back to that very reporter and never heard anything. And waited, never heard anything. Finally, he called, and I got back to him and told him it was old news. And I believe he went to the Boston Phoenix as well, never heard anything back. So Tom thought it was incredibly important for our story to convey that this man, this is not the first time this man had been sharing this information. He'd been doing it for years, trying to get his voice heard, because Phil, for such a long time, was all that amazing investigative journalism that you see in the film that is being lauded, you know, so rightly so. All that work they do in the basements, all those directories, Phil, by pure instinct, was doing that years before on his own in Boston College Library, and he sued the Worcester Diocese where his case was to get discovery, so he got all these documents pointing to that there was agreement amongst the higher-ups in the Worcester Diocese that bad priests were being moved around. This is all stuff Phil did on his own. So Tom wanted a real sense of that. But then I will also say Phil has become a super close friend in this process, and he has said that early on he thought, yeah, I was a little more angry than I was, but then friends of his from around that time said, are you sure about that, Phil? I remember you back then, and you were, I thought that was right on. So he's told me that since, and we've laughed about it a lot, because now, so many years have passed, he's just such an amazing, amazing individual, one of the most gentle people I've ever met. But I've done a few interviews with him, you know, with him, and sat beside him. And when he talks about this, when he talks about this issue, there is such an intensity that comes off of him. There's a real, real, you can feel what it takes to be the survivor that he is. It's not just that he's, you know, a good guy that something bad happened to. The reason he is still such a strong force in the survivor community and indeed in his own life is because he's just made of something else, I think. He's like one of those super athletes almost. He's just made of something very, very special. So to bring it back to your question, I think he might have been a little more intense and angry that day than he originally remembered.
Well, and to me, I felt it came off as passionate and mm-hmm. not stereotypical of a victim who is, you know, maybe hesitant or, you know, not unsure of themselves, like a very sure of themselves sort of a person. And, yeah, I think it's and that's also kind of a testament of playing a character who is a real person and
yeah.
trying, you know, sometimes people don't know themselves and people around them know them more, you know, because you don't view yourself in a certain light. I mean, so how did you work with Phil? Did you, meet with him before shooting? Did you, you know, talk to him during shooting? Is there any, like, you know, certain tips or whatever that he kind of gave you?
Phil, I heard an interview from 2012 that Josh Singer, who wrote the script with Tom McCarthy, I forget exactly when, but it was in 2012, about a 3.5-hour interview with Phil. And I immediately said, how can I get in touch with this man? Do you think he'd be okay with it? And Phil was so generous from the get-go. I went up to Boston immediately, started spending time with him, and really spent a terrific amount of time together, as much as we could. And he was just, what I thought was like, oh, this is great. Well, you know, what a treasure for an actor, quickly became something so much bigger. And I think that's one of the reasons, on a kind of a meta level, what I'm talking about is why the film is so good, because no matter what anyone is doing in the film, every single person working in that film really felt like they were doing the film for something bigger. And so Phil was so, so generous. So, for instance, I was at his home, and we were going through the original clippings. He was showing the original letters written to and from the priest that had abused him when he was in jail, just all this amazing stuff. And one little story, Phil... In 1992, Phil had full-blown AIDS, was really on death's door, and he went to his therapist and said, I'd like to get a bottle of sleeping pills to take myself out because I don't want to put my family through, you know, finding my body or something or life support. And he was really, really very ill. He was diagnosed HIV positive in 84, and full-blown AIDS in 92. He went to his therapist, and his therapist said, I'm not comfortable doing that without you talking to your AIDS doc first. So Phil went to his AIDS doctor. He wanted to get his kind of agreement before he prescribed Phil for the sleeping pills. So he went to his AIDS doc, and his AIDS doc was this very thinking outside the box young guy. I think he might have been at Mass General at the time, and now he's at the Fenway. in Boston, just a brilliant, brilliant man from what I understand. And he said, listen, I know you've tried AZT and it didn't really work with you, but I have an idea for you about a lower dosage. And if you try that, if you promise me you'll try that, I'll give you the prescription for the sleeping pills. So he gave him both, and Phil took the lower dosage of AZT and literally bounced back within days. During that time, yeah, it's such an incredible story. He really, there could be a story, a film, a book about Phil, you know, that would be amazing. So he's looking at the paper thinking, well, it looks like I've got another Christmas. What do you get your family when you know you've got another Christmas? He's feeling very, very, you know, lucky to have a few more months. And in the back of the Boston Globe, he's going through the Filene's ads and the TJ Maxx ads. He finds this little blurb about Father Holly, this guy who had abused him when he was 11 in the Worcester Diocese out in Douglas, Mass. And this is a case about an abuse that took place in New Mexico in the 1970s. There's two victims that spoke out. And Phil had never heard that this man had abused anybody. He thought he was the only one. So he called the Globe and said, is there any way you can put me in touch with either of those victims? And they said, well, who the heck are you? And he said, well, I was actually abused by that same priest. And they said, okay. They put him in touch with one of the guys. And the guy said to him, how many times in your life do you get to actually help somebody? Speaking out about this has been incredible for me and for people. I've been getting, you find out that you're not alone in this, indeed, with the same perpetrator in many cases. So he really encouraged Phil, like, to take this chance to really do something good for someone else. And so Phil spoke out and went to the Globe and became kind of a local celebrity in the survivor community. This is all in 1992. As he's telling me this story in his home, he showing me all the clippings, the articles, and then he pulls out the bottle of Seconal. He still has this bottle of the sleeping pills. Yeah, just more than you could ever ask for as an actor. So on the other end, further down the line now, the night before we shot, Phil just was very, very openly looking at the script. He sent Josh and Tom like something like 4 pages of notes about the script. It was very, you know, he's just a very, very focused guy, and I thought this should change in the film. And I'm not sure what agreement they came to, but in any respect, Phil and I were talking the night before we shot that big scene, and he was very passionate about wanting to get certain points into the scene and certain things that wouldn't have been said. So it's just such a testament to Josh and Tom as writers, as leaders on this project, that they were able to be so collaborative, and they were unbelievably collaborative with Phil and I. So, for instance, things that went into that scene, really in the 11th hour, I told Tom, I said, look, I can do it this way with this information. I memorized like 3 different versions of the scene, actually maybe more, saying, you know, what about this detail? What about this detail? What about this? And Tom and I kind of went through it point by point. He said, yes to this, no to this. Yeah, that's great. We don't need this. We don't need that. And so, honestly, right before we shot, like a day or two before we shot, Tom and I collaborated on the script, all coming from Phil. So things like that went into the scene late were the fact that it wasn't just boys being abused, that it was girls, that it was women. The whole notion of spiritual abuse, which is a very specific kind of clergy abuse, that these perpetrators are kind of using their standing as representatives of God, and indeed the victim is confronted with abuse on a physical and a spiritual level. Phil, you know, still went to confession with this same priest as he was being abused, as he would say his confession. So I can't even imagine what kind of internal dismantling that would do to someone. And just a couple other points in the scene that were all collaboration with Phil. So it was a completely original experience for me in terms of the involvement with someone who's living.
Yeah, well, I mean, I started thinking, too, like, you know, this could have easily been a documentary, but at the same time, you know, it probably wouldn't have gotten as, well, who knows if it would have gotten as much attention. Have you seen, you know, other films? I believe Deliver Us from Evil. Did you, you know, watch any of those documentaries? You know, like, I guess, what do you think the benefits were of telling a narrative story versus a documentary?
Great question. I'd seen most of the films about this subject, I think, or at least a lot of them, including the earlier narrative ones, like The Boys of St. Vincent and Priest and stuff like that. Great question. I think that there's kind of a genius to what Tom has done with this film in making it and shooting it and editing it the way he did. For instance, like with that direction, that it was clear he didn't want of me in that scene, that big scene when I go into the Globe. It was clear that he didn't want it to be some kind of tearjerker scene. He didn't want there to be any moments along the way that were moments for you to stop and reflect and cry. There wasn't any commenting going on. He didn't point the finger at any one institution or individual more than another. There was a lot of gray areas in every character. I think the benefit of telling the story the way he did in such a tight way, it just points like almost like he's drawing back a bow, in my opinion, to the moment at the end of the film when you see all those cities where there's been so much abuse all over the world, so much clergy abuse. I think that the film is structured in such an ingenious way. People go into it thinking it's going to be some devastating kind of download of horrific information. And it isn't. It's about the gradual waking up to a problem that we all knew was there. And I think the experience of telling that story, it's almost like the film is like the opening up of an eye. And at the end, you're staring at all those cities going, oh, my God, this is this big a problem that I kind of always knew was there. I feel like that's what Tom is doing with the structure of the piece. And I think you can only do that with a narrative piece. I think a documentary would be incredible. I still think a documentary would be incredible about this. But it might not have that same momentum. And I think that's one of the reasons, honestly, that the film is doing so well is because people are seeing something that they don't quite expect. They go into it thinking it's going to be one thing. And, I mean, it's devastating as much as it is. It's for me, a very, very, I just am filled with adrenaline by the end of the film. I feel awake.
Yeah, I was going to say the same sort of thing where it kept a momentum, like you were saying, of an uncovering of something that, yeah, you knew was there already. And, you know, I think it was interesting to see how there was, you know, a lot of the people involved weren't necessarily, you know, practicing Catholics, but maybe lapsed Catholics. And, you know, in your own sort of aspect, has this affected, you know, how you're, you know, thinking about your own spirituality?
I don't think so, but I know that growing up Catholic, I had an immediate personal stake. I have friends that have been abused in schools that I went to, stuff that I didn't know about. I went to Catholic school for 7th through 12th grade. But I would definitely say, and certainly lapsed is a good word for it. That said, my wife and I were married in 2007 by a wonderful guy who's a dear friend, who's a Catholic priest, a Jesuit from my high school, who's no longer in my high school, but really, really great guy. He and I had coffee last week, actually. I've been dying to talk to him. He loves the film. And I was really like, God, I'd love to do like an anonymous interview with you and say, so what's going on? What are they talking about inside because of the film? And, yeah, he said that the priest that he's close with, they really, really do love the film, these fellow Jesuits of his. So I wouldn't say that it has dismantled anything that wasn't already kind of dismantled, to be totally honest. My mom goes to church literally almost every day. She is the biggest fan of the film. She was utterly shocked when Pope Francis, for whatever reason, had that audience with Kim Davis when he was here in the States. That she was appalled that, she's like, what is Kim Davis doing Meeting the Pope, you know, the woman who's against, you know, the clerk who's against, the court clerk who's against gay marriage.
Right.
She's like, why isn't Phil Saviano meeting the Pope? Phil Saviano, the Pope should be meeting Phil Saviano. She's just such a huge fan of Phil now, too. She is in awe of him, and rightly so. So, no, personally, no. But it definitely, you know, I feel very hopeful about Pope Francis. So I guess there is something still in there, deep down in, that wants house to be fully cleaned. You know, any institution that's self-regulating, in my opinion, is rife, potentially rife with corruption. Any institution, any organization. So some part of me is like, yeah, I'm blessed. I don't go to church. But I know deep down in, I think there's a little bit of hope in there. Kind of like Mike Resendi's character, you know, Mark Ruffalo's character says on the porch, I kind of always thought I'd go back. I think there's a little truth to that with me, but I don't, you know. Now, I was very clear, you know, I knew a lot of stories about stuff like this going in, and I felt I really had to represent them. And then when I met Phil, I realized in that scene, like, he was speaking for so many people, the fact that so many people don't know this story, I was then the proxy. I was speaking for that many more people who were going to see the film. So, no, I would not say that it's not kept me from going to church. I already wasn't going.
Well, I was also going to ask, you know, just a response from people, you know, is as much press it is, you know, this sort of topic has gotten, it really hasn't gotten, it still hasn't gotten enough. And I thought one of the interesting things too that I had, you know, found upon research was that, you know, yes, the instance upon, you know, priests who abuse are, you know, is around 6%. That's actually not an anomaly as far as the rest of just the general population. But
in terms of abuse, you mean
right.
Sexual abuse in the world at large, not just with the church?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I find is a very important point.
Really important. One of the most incredible things of this whole experience for me was right after we finished shooting that day for that big scene when I go into the club, two guys walked up to me and said, I just want to shake your hand. You know, that was exactly what it was like that day. It was Walter Robinson and Mike Resendiz, and I didn't know who they were, and I just got goosebumps and just hugged them. I was so, so grateful. So I was chatting with those guys for the rest of the day on set, and Walter Robinson said he thinks that the great kind of unexplored frontier of investigation is just family sexual abuse, because there's such taboo about people talking about that, that, you know, he's aware of a lot of stories in that regard, that, and people are very, very unwilling to come forward and try and find any kind of advocacy, you know. So I think you're right. I think, you know, also that ties to another point that I've been really starting to get obsessed by, that the statute of limitations has changed in a lot of states with respect to civil cases, you know, in terms of situations like this, cases like this. But it hasn't in New York. New York hasn't amended theirs. And I was talking to my friend, the priest who married us last week, and I said, well, why is the church lobbying against this? Why are they doing this? And he said, well, it's, you know, it's money. They don't want to lose any more money, and they're going to continue to lobby. But one of the things that the church is aware of in New York State is that New York State isn't really budging on this either, because if they were to amend and change their statute of limitations, we wouldn't just find out about that many more priests. Oh, sorry, here we go. So Terry McKiernan let us know that, when I met him, that there's a lot less cases of clergy abuse in New York State than there really are. There's a lot less that's reported because the statute of limitations hasn't changed. So it's not just the church is lobbying against it to hang on and not have any more cases, lose any more money, but New York State doesn't want to change things, because it wouldn't just be clergy we'd find out about. It'd be public school teachers. It'd be therapists that were hired by the state for people. That there is a tremendous amount of abuse in the in cases in the state. And were they to change this, you know, there'd be the church footing the bill for those cases, but in many, many other cases, the state would be footing the bill. So, kind of bringing it back to what you're saying about other cases at large in the world, there's big institutions that do not want to acknowledge this for, in my opinion, financial reasons.
Yeah, I think that's why movies like this are important, because it gets it out in front of an audience that wouldn't necessarily see it, and it just reinforces, you know, the ideas that people know already. I mean, that's sort of what the movie is itself, is, you know, all these people sort of knew it was happening, but to just keep going after it and not letting it go. And I think that's something that is ramping up more and more, and is, you know, a testament to, you know, people like Phil Saviano and the organization that he works with, and all the other people who really contribute to those organizations.
Yeah. And about Phil, you know, he wasn't really doing this as a member of an organization for so many years. He was doing it on his own. It really took, you know, it's one thing to have a team with you. It's another thing to just be doing it on your own. And that's what it takes in a lot of cases, and that's a terrifying, terrifying prospect when you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed the film. I thought you were fantastic in it. You really conveyed a passion that was really perfect for not only the film itself, but just, I think, for the character and representing him.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate the your questions. It's a real pleasure to always talk about, because it's, in some respects, you know, an issue that continues.
Oh, yeah.
In many respects, you know. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, one thing that Walter Robinson said to me that day as well was that when the first stories were reported back in 2002, more and more calls came in. Even earlier in the 90s, when there'd be one story about one person, more calls would come into the paper. And so on each level that the story got bigger, 2002, more and more people called in. Hopefully, as you say, if there's more and more press about the film and more people see the film all over the world, it could really go a long way towards helping people speak out and hopefully changing some policies and institutions that want to keep things hidden.
Thank you for listening. Spotlight is now in theaters. I want to give a special shout out to my co-managing editor, Liz Whittemore, who recently had a beautiful baby boy. I can't wait to meet him. Good night, everyone.